Ramana.
We should try to say a few more points about that. So one of the interesting issues that we were talking about yesterday was the question of whether negative kavana exists. And the assumption that seems to be widespread, although not 100% unanimous, that it's possible to cancel a mitzvah. So if one has a circumstance where the details are in place to fulfill a mitzvah, but it's not ideal for whatever reason, we're not assuming the person is anti-religious, but quite the opposite, he'd rather do a mitzvah under perfect circumstances. So then many assumed that there is such a thing as negative kavana. We saw not everybody. There was a view in Rishonim that afilu omed v'tzovech, even if somebody is standing and screaming, I'm not interested in the mitzvah, still it might be the mitzvah is still fulfilled. That was the ra'ah that the Beis Yosef quoted in the Ritva, and Rosh Hashanah has a comment like that. But many others thought that there was a concept of negative kavana, and that it could be true whether or not you think mitzvos trichos kavana. Because if you say mitzvos need kavana, then it makes sense that yes, if you have negative kavana, then that will undo the mitzvah. But even if you believe mitzvos ain't trichos kavana, that if we say mitzvahs don't need kavana per se, maybe that doesn't really mean that mitzvahs don't need kavana. Maybe it just means that mitzvahs do need kavana, but that the kavana is presumed. But if you are actively contradicting it, so then it's no longer presumed, and then it will still be effective in negating the mitzvah. So an extension of this concept is the also controversial concept, but also one that seems to be accepted, of conditional kavana. That maybe then one could say, all right, so now I could make my kavana either work or not, depending on whether it works for me. So to give an example from the context of Kriya Shema, because that's what we're talking about. So let's say, especially nowadays when Kriya Shema is early, let's say you want to go to Shul Shabbos morning, and the minyan, you're not sure if it's going to make Zman Kriya Shema or not. So, alright, so you can say, alright, if I'm not sure if it's going to make Zman Kriya Shema, so then no big deal, so let me say Shema before davening. So, some might say that is a big deal. Vilna Gaon and others felt that you should ideally, or maybe more than ideally, daven in such a way that Shema is said bizman. So you look at it like this and say, what should I do? Then on the one hand, I don't want to miss Zman Kriya Shema. But on the other hand, if I'm worried that Shul's not going to make it on time, so I'd rather rely on the opinion that I can say it earlier and daven rest afterwards than miss it completely. So therefore many have this idea of a conditional mitzvah that I can say Shema before davening and say as follows, that if it turns out that we get up to it in time and shul, so then this Shema should be nothing. But if it turns out that, right, or it should be, right, not nothing, it should be like, that learning. But if it turns out that we don't get up to it in time, so then I would like this to count, so then at least I have, or a similar concept comes up, assuming this is what's at play there. The Shulchan Aruch quotes the Matzah of Victory, Sfiras HaOmer. Let's say you're in Shul and they're going to count Sfiras HaOmer at a time when you would rather wait until later. Many different shittas to when the earliest time for Sfiras HaOmer is. So you'd rather say, I want to be Machmer, I want to wait till it's fully dark, according to everybody, time for Sfiras HaOmer. So that's great, but you also recognize that there's a possibility that if you're not in shul anymore to remind you, you're going to forget completely. So you'd rather rely on a shita that you could do it earlier than forget it completely. But ideally, you'd like to remember at the right time or at the ideal time and do it later. So maybe what the Shulchan Aruch is describing, if we were talking about Sfiras HaOmer, we could explain some other possibilities looking at it in that context, but maybe what's going on there is that one could say, alright, I will count here now. If it turns out I remember later, then I want this to be nothing. And I can count later with a bracha, that's what the Shulchan Aruch describes. And even though normally during Sfiras HaOmer, We say you shouldn't even tell somebody what day it is without phrasing things in such a way that you're not going to be yotzei. And yet here, we allow you to count Sphira, actually, and yet count with a bracha later. And maybe what's going on is that your whole mitzvah is conditional, that if you turn out to remember later, what you do now should be nothing, so we let you count later with a bracha. And if it turns out that you don't remember later, so then retroactively this should have kavanah for the mitzvah. So it's an interesting structure, and again, in that context, could be that there's something else at play. There's a couple of different ways to understand what's going on, but it seems to be that you have this conditional kavanah structure that allows you not only to possibly negate a mitzvah, but then to do so in a conditional way and say, maybe I'll negate it, maybe I won't, depending on how things turn out. So it's a fascinating possible application of how this Kavanah can play a role in a couple of different directions. So, alright, so with that all being said, so let's assume that if we were to say mitzvos ein tzrichos kavanah, if we're going to take the view, and again, as we've said, it's kind of an open question, we still don't really know what the actual psak is, but if you say mitzvos ein tzrichos kavanah, so do we mean even l'chachila? Do we mean that the opinion that says mitzvos don't need kavanah are saying so that even if you do remember and you are aware, there's still no Indian to have Kavanah at all? Kavanah is completely meaningless? So is that the case? Or will we say that, no, clearly, ideally, a mitzvah should have Kavanah. It's just that, but yeah, okay, it could be okay without it. So many assume that way. Many assume that the idea of saying mitzvah, saying tzrichos Kavanah, clearly there is something lacking, that ideally a mitzvah will have kavanah. Maybe it just means that the mitzvah doesn't have to be done again, but strictly speaking, you should have had kavanah. So there are those who not only say that, but say that in a way that's pretty powerful. So for example, the Teshuvas Tvar Yehoshua was written by Yehoshua Ehrenberg, who was a dying in Tel Aviv. So he points out that the Ramban in his commentary to Chumash says that the idea of is that when a person is doing mitzvah, so he would have to have as much awareness and intent as possible. So if that's the case, so then it sounds like even if the mitzvah itself doesn't require you to have kavanah, but maybe Avodas Hashem requires you to have kavanah. So it could be coming from two separate places. That maybe, okay, the mitzvah is done whether you have kavanah or not. But it's not right for a person to be performing mitzvahs without intent and without awareness. So he's missing on a different level. And it's interesting, if you want to get very lumdish about it, again, it's been a pretty lumdish topic already, but there are those who maintain that some of the Rishonim have, not all the Rishonim agree with this, but some Rishonim assert that the concept of l'chachila and b'di'evet, the idea that you could do a mitzvah ideally one way, but even if you don't do it, it's still good after the fact. But that doesn't make sense when it comes to mitzvahs in the Torah. Maybe mitzvahs are abundant, is such a concept. But a mitzvah in the Torah has got to be all or nothing. So if that's true, if those Rishonim are correct, not all the Rishonim are like this, but if that's correct, so then how could we say that, all right, l'chachila you should have kavanah, but b'di'evet is still good? If there's no such distinction of l'chachila and b'di'evet and mitzvah d'oraisa, how could that work? So you could say because it's two separate things. The mitzvah itself doesn't have different gradations. The mitzvah itself is all or nothing. It's going to either be fulfilled or not. But there is l'chachila, an idea of kavanah that comes from a different mitzvah. And that's for one's personal observance. So one should be acting in such a way that he's acting with full intent and awareness. But the mitzvah of luvav, whatever it is, let's say, doesn't, the mitzvah of matzah doesn't require that. I should point out, we talk about matzah, so there is a Ran in Rosh Hashanah that Mishnah Berurah actually advocates for, that has a much more stringent view of what we mean by kavanah. And we mentioned, we kind of alluded to at the beginning, I didn't explain this, that the Gemara, where it talks about having kavanah for matzah, has kind of a funny example. It talks about kafu parsoyim. The person is basically kidnapped and he has matzah forced on him. So if I had to make up an example for matzah without kavanah, it's so much easier to come up with an example than that. You know, a person is scrounging around in his house and it's all that he finds, or he thinks that it's something else and he doesn't realize that it's actually matzah. So the Ran assumes that when we say mitzvahs don't need kavanah, if that's the case, so we mean that the person is not specifically thinking about doing a mitzvah when he does it. But he has to at least be aware that it's Pesach, and he has to be aware of the basic elements. If he's completely clueless, so then maybe that would be even less. So that's actually a pretty big chumra, because we don't necessarily always factor that in. So he's saying that essentially that's why the Gemara has a case, not where somebody has no idea what's going on. He knows that it's Pesach, and he knows about matzah, it's just he wouldn't choose to be eating it. He is being compelled to eat it through somebody else's exhortation. But he is aware, at least, that it is Pesach. So that kind of raises the ante a little bit in terms of what we're talking about in terms of kavanah. So okay, so let's say you need that. But then, if you don't have kavanah, so then do we say that even l'chachil you don't need kavanah? So we just saw that one way is to say that there is this external consideration of avodas Hashem requiring intent in general, and then there are those who go even further. And this is really kind of scary. There are those who maintain that maybe when we say mitzvos don't need kavanah, maybe we're saying something very limited. Not just that you are lacking in your own personal avodas Hashem if you don't have kavanah, but maybe even on the mitzvah level, maybe we're saying something very narrow. And we're saying that the mitzvah, okay, so there's an obligation to do the mitzvah. And if you do the mitzvah without kavanah, you no longer have the obligation. The mitzvah is addressed. But you, essentially, are not accomplishing anything personally. There's no schar, so to speak, for the mitzvah. There's a Meiri that sounds like that. Meiri, in some of his writings, some of the latest Svarim quote from Meiri, that maybe that's what it means. That's really very depressing. It means that if that's the case, then clearly the chachil will want to have kavanah, because you're completely not really personally connected to it without kavanah. It's just
accomplish nothing.
Right. So the mitzvah is checked off. You don't have an obligation anymore, but your connection to the mitzvah might be very limited. There are those who suggest, the yeshiva was learning Yevamos this year. So Ashkenazi Jews, for the most part, did not fulfill Yibum Bizman Hazeh. So why is that the case? Why is the practice not to fulfill Yibum? Sounds like from the Gemara, even the Torah tells us there's essentially two choices. That if Rahman al-Tawar, a man dies without children, so his brother is really obligated to marry his wife. And if he refuses to do it, okay, so then there's an option of Chalitza. But it sounds clear from the Gemara that Chalitza is second best. But today, at least among Ashkenazim, you don't find Yibum performed at all. So why is Yibum not performed? So it's connected to the view of Abishol, in the Gemara, the Tana, the Mishnah of Abishol, that Abishol maintained that Yibum requires a complete purity of intent. The person is only doing this because of the mitzvah. And if he doesn't have complete purity of intent, so then it's an Avera, because it's really an Erva. For a person to marry his sister-in-law is considered to be an act of Arayas. So we would only allow it because of the mitzvah. And Abishol's view is that the mitzvah only works if the person is doing so completely for the purpose of the mitzvah, and we're worried that that's not always the case. We're worried that there could be any other motive mixed in, and therefore we're going to be left with a serious Torah prohibition, a serious Issacharis, very serious Torah prohibition. So therefore we don't have to allow it in practice. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman discusses this in his Kovei Tzaris, and he suggests that in general the whole process of Yibum is, of course, a Chiddush, because you have to overcome this Isser of Erva. So that requires that the person doing the action is really in fulfillment of a mitzvah that's going to outweigh the prohibition. And maybe the view of Abishol is that, right, that you're saying that, okay, the Yibum will be performed. Clearly there will be an act here, which is significant in itself, because if you have an Esser Erva, so normally Kedushin isn't Tofes, the act doesn't even have internal validity. So maybe here, okay, the mitzvah of Yibum will exist, but the person doing it will have no Kiyum Mitzvah, will have no credit for it, And if he doesn't have a key mitzvah, there's nothing which can outweigh his prohibition, his iser erva, and therefore he's left with a serious problem. So if that's the case, so all right, so maybe that's why we don't put this into practice. And maybe that's the same idea that has a very limited understanding of mitzvah sein tzrichos kavana, meaning that, okay, the mitzvah could be accomplished on some level, it's going to be checked off, you don't have to do it again, but there's really very little credit accruing to the person doing it, and therefore, if that's the case, so certainly it's going to be a massive lechachila that somebody is going to want to have kavana. So this could plug back into our Gemara, into our Mishnah, not 100%, but you know, again, the Mishnah is trying to say that, first the Mishnah says, a person finds himself saying the words of Shema when the time of Shema comes, in Kivan Libo Yasa. So the Gemara starts to say, okay, Mitzvah Shrichas Kavana, and then it says, nah, not necessarily, don't derive that from here. So it doesn't work perfectly with the words, but one could say, alright, the Mitzvah is still fulfilled without Kavana. But nonetheless, the Mishnah is going to talk about Kavanah because for so many reasons you're going to want to have Kavanah anyway. It doesn't work perfectly with the language of the Mishnah because still the Mishnah seems to make it contingent. Right? It seems to say, im kivim libo yatsa, implying that you're not yotze at all without it. So it's, it doesn't flow perfectly, but it, maybe that's a little bit again what the Gemara could perhaps be alluding to. It's the two structures that the mitzvah could still be fulfilled, but certainly l'chachila we're going to require and we're going to recommend that a person have kavana anyway. Just perhaps as a closing note to the sugya, we should mention that when we talked about, for example, this idea of presumed kavana, so we used a phrase, borrowed an expression, as Nodeb Yehuda and others did, from the beginning of the Gemara in Masechta Zvachim, in the opening Sugi of Zvachim. So the first mission in Zvachim talks about Kol Zvachim Shnizbechu Shlo Lishma Ksherim, that there is a concept of Lishma by a carbon. It's a little complicated. The Mishnah says, you know, it's kosher without Lishma for a certain context. In other contexts, it does need Lishma, and that even when it does have, even when it doesn't have Lishma and it's kosher, it means that the carbon is the same kind of structure which mentioned a minute ago, actually. The carbon works, but it's not credited to the bialim, it's not credited to the person who brings it. So in that context, the Mishnah has this expression, stama lishma, that even if you don't actually say anything, but the assumption is the person goes through the whole process of the carbon, does everything else right, so the default position is that it's lishma. So we had used that phrase, as many did, as perhaps a way of expressing that by kavana by mitzvahs as well, that there is inherent kavana, and maybe that's what mitzvahs ain't riches kavana means. That you don't have to actively have kavana because the kavana is presumed, even though mitzvahs really do need kavana. So many quibble, though, with that terminology. Baruch Be'er has an essay about this in his Sefer Berachos Shmuel and Gittin, and Zerbitz Lepanovich in the Sefer Zecha Yitzchak, and he points out, they both point out, as others do as well, that the terminology is not really exactly the same. That Lishma and Kavana don't necessarily mean the exact same thing. We've been kind of using them interchangeably, others use them interchangeably, but maybe they shouldn't be used interchangeably. Maybe they mean two different things. That the Lishma, something being done for its own sake, is a concept that we find by the creation of certain objects for a purpose. So where do we find the Lishma and Halacha? So we find it by Kurbanos. We find it by, say, a Sefer Torah or a Tefillin, by something that has a certain Kedusha to it. We find it, there was a discussion, it's not explicit in the Babli, the Talmud Yerushalmi talks about it, and the Ramban talks about it, that we find it by the Beis HaMikdash. It makes sense, you know, that there is a idea of creating a kedusha through intent, through dedication, let's say. If something is dedicated for its own sake. The fascinating concept, just parenthetically, that some of the students of the Avnei Nezer, wrote a classic sefer on Hilchos Shavas called Egle Tal. So his students, included among his students was the author of the Chalkis Yoav, and the Kajik Lover Rav, and they both connect the concept of Malachas Machsheves to Lishma, which is a fascinating mixing of terms. That we assume that Shabbos, the Malacha, has to be matched to a standard of Malachas Machshavas, which is a mysterious concept in general. Gemara never fully defines it. So these Mechabrim connected to the idea that Mishkan, you know, the Torah, the whole idea of Malachas Machshavas not only is mysterious, but the Torah doesn't say it in the context of Shabbos at all. So the Mishnah in Chagigah says that the Hilchos Shabbos, it's amazing how inexplicit it is in the Torah. The Torah tells us so little about what a Malacha is, and it sounds like from the Gemara in Chagigah that this is part of it, that even this concept of Malachas Machshavas, which is so central, you can't go 2 feet in Hilchos Shabbos without talking about Malachas Machshavas, but the Torah doesn't say it in the context of Shabbos. The Torah says it in the context of the Mishkan. And we derive the Mishkan, the Malachos, Malachos from the Mishkan, some Malachos Machshavas comes from the Mishkan. So some explain that that's how the students, the Adonizer, have it in their Sfarim, that by the Mishkan, the Mishkan had to be done Lishma. So Lishma, Malachos Machshavas, is the same idea in their context. So you have to do the actions of the Mishkan with a certain dedication. And so too, Malacha, therefore, requires that type of dedication as well. Okay.
Lishma sounds to me more like an ulterior motive.
So it's an interesting question if that fits or not. So maybe that, so is Lishma about the motive as much, or is it about also just awareness that it should be for purpose? So it's an interesting question whether or not that fits. So in terms of Hilchos Shabbos, so I can see what Malachos Machshavas means. It's an interesting question if that definition fits or not. But so when we create an item that has to be holy, so there is a concept of lishma. Or if you talk about a get, you find it there also. Even though a get, as Baruch Be'er points out, and also his Talmud of Tzvi Goldstein, it's a great posek. Yeah, and we wrote the Tshuvas Eimei Kalacha. They just came out with another volume of this posthumously printed Tshuvas. So the first volume, the Tshuvas Eimei Kalacha. So he quotes Baruch Be'er saying this as well, and he takes the explanation a little bit further, and he goes on to say, so even with a get doesn't have any inyan of Kedusha, it's not holy, it's really, so to speak, a secular religious document in the sense it doesn't have a Kedusha to it, but it clearly has a status, so you have to create the status that it's effective in doing what it does. So that status, okay, is created through Lishma. But Kavana is something else. Kavana is the awareness a person has when he's doing something, that he's doing it for a certain spiritual purpose. And Kavana and Lishma are not exactly the same thing. They don't really have the same point of focus. That's really a Siya. A Lishma is about how something is created. It's really about the object itself, and the object requiring a certain dedication in order for it to be meaningful towards its status, while Kavana is about the person doing something. The person who's doing it wants to be connected to it, wants to have this schar, let's say, that comes with doing the mitzvah. So that's a whole different concept. So based on that idea, he and others suggest this concept we were talking about earlier about the conditional Kavana, about negating Kavana and the like. So that makes sense for Kavana. It doesn't make sense for Lishma, that the Lishma is not something that can be conditional or can be retroactively negated. Either something is dedicated for its purpose or it isn't. But when it comes to Kavana, so Kavana is about the individual's relationship to something. So then the individual has more control over that, so then he can make it conditional, he can turn it on and off. It's something that is more subject to one's personal connection. So that's the whole discussion, whether or not there is really room to say Lishma and Kavan in the same breath, are they really the same idea, or are there significant differences, and could that affect how they play out? And then there's a lot of terminology when you learn in the sugya of Lishma and Svachim. So there's a lot of terminology that could be helpful in the context of Kavan. That's the debate, how much it applies. For example, in the context of Lishma, so there is this idea that Kala Osa al Das Rishona Hu Osa, that if you start off with an intent to Lishma, so then it doesn't necessarily have to be repeated in each context. So we say that by Kavana as well, that perhaps we can rely initially on a dedication that is at the beginning, or is it something that has to be constantly renewed? So that's the discussion. And one could say, when it comes to Kavana, maybe it's different, that if Kavana is about the religious awareness, so to speak, and it's about the connection that one maintains to what they're doing, so then maybe it needs to be more ongoing. It's not just enough to have that awareness at the beginning. It has to be there consistently in order for one to be really connecting to the mitzvah fully. Okay, so that's a little bit of a taste of the sugya of the mitzvah Sirchus Kavana. So there is a lot to be said about it. And our Gemara, again, seems to try to preserve the mystery. And you might think that, bottom line, okay, our Mishnah tells us something about it, and again, the mystery persists. So just, again, in terms of why it's such a mystery, because the Gemara doesn't really take a stand on it. Our Gemara here doesn't allow us to read too much into the Mishnah. And the Shulchan Aruch quotes two days and says, some say you don't need Kavana, some say that you do need Kavana, and seems to favor the view that you do need Kavana, in the context of Kriya Shema, in the context of our Mishnah. And yet again, there was a debate, what did the Shulchan Aruch mean? Does the Shulchan Aruch mean that, yes, I'm concluded in Kavana, or is the Shulchan Aruch just saying it to be safe, saying it out of suffix? And is it just because Kriya Shema is a Mitzvah in the Torah? Maybe the Rabbanans would have said otherwise, because of a suffix, maybe there's room to be more lenient. And is it also because maybe Shema doesn't have an action? Shema is just words, which could also be Talmud Torah, could also be any other context, and therefore we require that one should have an intent when actually doing this mitzvah, but maybe not necessarily when it comes to other mitzvahs. Okay, so
imagine this, many hold that l'chatila, yes, but you have a no. Are there people that hold even l'chatila, you don't have to have kavanah?
So that's the question. It doesn't seem like anyone explicitly does. Right? So the question is, what does this phrase mean when the Gemara has this expression, mitzvos ein tzrichos kavana? So what does that phrase mean? So we saw essentially that it could mean a couple things, right? It could mean that mitzvos really do need kavana, but the kavana is presumed. So then really mitzvos ein tzrichos kavana is another version of mitzvos tzrichos kavana. Or it could mean that the mitzvah don't need kavanah, but the person doing the mitzvah needs kavanah. So the mitzvah maybe is going to be fulfilled, but maybe the individual is not accomplishing so much. And then within that, we saw a couple ways of saying that either the mitzvah is done, but the person doesn't connect to it, or even if it's not a problem as far as the rules of the mitzvah, lulav, whatever it is, shofar, you're fine, but maybe there is a side obligation that avodah saleh, you have to have full commitment in religious activity, and therefore a person is doing something else wrong. So the mitzvah itself, hilchos shofar and hilchos lulav, there's no issue. But hilchos avodah Hashem in general, maybe there is an issue. So that's a couple of things to think about. Now the truth is, one could actually make a Musar Shmuz, perhaps it's particularly relevant for 9 days. So just actually wanted to talk about that for a second. So in terms of agenda, so we discussed, so Friday morning is supposed to be halacha, and we decided basically to go straight because we're learning halachic topics anyway, but probably should talk about the Tisha B'Av a little bit. I mean, last year we spent a few days talking about Tisha B'Av, so this year we're not taking off as much time, but maybe specifically the idea of Tisha B'Av Shechalios B'Shabbos, which has its own unique Lamdisha concepts and halachic concepts. Maybe Friday morning we should spend a little bit of time talking about that, but also today we could say, based on this, we'll get a little bit off the Derech HaMusar, that we know the Gemara seems to say that the Gemara has a suggestion in a couple of places about what it was that led to the Churban, even though the Jews were observant, even though the Jews were fulfilling the mitzvahs of the Torah. So how could it be that they were nonetheless judged worthy of exile? We have a couple of different statements, the Sanhedrin and the like, and it's one of the ideas the Gemara has. But the Gemara also has a statement in Maseches Nedarim, a topic of a lot of commentary, where the Gemara says, "Al shelo berchu al Torah tchila," they didn't recite Birchas HaTorah, and that prompts a lot of discussion of itself, because since when is Brachas HaTorah the most important mitzvah in the Torah? It's Machlokes, if it is a mitzvah in the Torah, why is it that this is what's going to get the Jews thrown out of the land? And there are those who suggest that what the Gemara is trying to get at is not necessarily that Brachas HaTorah specifically is such a crucial ideal, but that it shows a certain level of connection and spiritual impact. So perhaps, for example, if the Jews were learning Torah, but they were doing so without Brachas HaTorah, they're doing so without any appreciation for what impact it's meant to have, so then all the Torah in the world is not going to change their behavior, it's going to leave them still acting in ways that are seriously deficient. So the Gemara is trying to say that the Torah is not enough. There has to be the Brachas HaTorah as well. There has to be that connection to what's going on that's going to create the impact. So that's essentially perhaps very much the core of the sugya, that a mitzvah might be fulfilled on its own, but if the individual doing it is not connected to it, it allows that to happen without any type of awareness, so then there is still a tremendous deficiency, even if, okay, the mitzvah is checked off, there's no need to go back and do it again, but the person doing it is lacking in a fundamental way. So in a very major sense, that might be one of the major themes of the Churban, but perhaps this sugya is alluding to that in a powerful way that's worth pondering as we are now significantly into the 9 days. It's worth giving that idea some attention. So I guess for Friday, maybe two things we should try to squeeze in. Talk a little bit about, say, Tisha B'Av Shechal Yos B'Shabbos, but also there is a sugya here about the tefillin, which we're not up to yet, but maybe we should try to sneak in a little bit, because the relationship of tefillin and Kriyat Shema and Tisha B'Av is a halachic question as well, which maybe we should try to address before Tisha B'Av. So it's a significant agenda. We'll try to leave all of that for Friday. And 6:20.